The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Managing GI Complications of Diabetes Mellitus is presented by Dr. Nathan Landisman.
When I first got this topic, you know, I was worried about losing people right before lunch with a long diabetes talk, sort of halfway between that breakfast and lunch drop-off. But then I realized the infinite wisdom of somebody that chose this topic, because I think it puts one solid foot in each of our two specialties of gastroenterology and surgical specialties. You know, these are a lot of these patients that fill my office as well as Dr. Hoffman's office with dyspepsia and irritable bowel syndrome type symptoms. So I think this is something that we see commonplace, but I think for you as surgeons to have these people show up in your office, whether you have a local GI or you're kind of the first line of defense, that you're seeing a lot of these patients that are showing up with these expectations that you're going to have a quick surgical fix for their symptoms. And I think that, you know, I've learned in life and in marriage that the key to happiness is reasonable expectations. So you want to make sure that these patients know that this is probably a medically treated problem as opposed to a surgical fix. And I think that if you can manage those expectations, I think you're happier, you feel like the patient's happier, and hopefully you're going to see some good results on the back end. I think also that the other thought is that when these patients have these GERD symptoms too that are sort of a combination of esophageal dysmotility, impaired gastric emptying, reflux, you know, and they're failing PPI therapy, these are the patients that are showing up in Dr. Smith's office as well saying, well, I'd love to just get a fundoplication because that's what I've read online that I need. And I think letting them know that if you end up doing a wrap without the proper investigation and all the excellent workup that he summarized, that these patients are going to be sort of destined to fail. You have a patient that has a disordered motility, you end up wrapping that patient, and then you end up with a patient that's severely unhappy afterwards because either their swallowing is worse or they end up with tremendous bloating because they can't vent with the inability to belch or vomit after that surgery. So I think it's really nice, you know, the infinite wisdom of the person that chose this topic, it's nice fodder for both of us to discuss. So this is a very prevalent complaint in gastroenterology as well as surgery, and sort of we need to understand the prevalence of GI complaints and diabetes in general. There are a lot of coexistent conditions that affect the GI system and diabetes, and we really want to appreciate all the treatment options. So medical, lifestyle, all those things together, sort of combining these modalities to make these patients happier and feel better. So we'll do sort of pre and post test that right now, you know, thinking, do we have little to offer patients with diabetes suffering from GI complaints? I think, you know, the goal of this lecture is to show you that we have quite a few options to treat these patients. And are they only pharmacologic, or are there other things that we can offer to these patients? I think we have other things. And also to think about, it may not be just the diabetes that's sort of causing issues in these patients. So thinking about coexistent conditions that can worsen these symptoms is also very important. I was amazed when I was preparing this slide deck as to how much of a worldwide impact diabetes has on our patient population. Over 9% of the U.S. population, which equates to about 380 million people worldwide, are affected by diabetes. And that number is going to almost double in the next 20 years. So really amazing cadre of patients that we're going to be asked to manage. And it affects virtually every organ system, with the degree of involvement being proportional to how long they've had the disease, how severe they have the disease, and what their associated comorbidities are. So I think our awareness is high, but I think our GI complications are under-recognized and under-treated. Again, I think a lot of these people very early with their bloating and other sort of nondescript GI complaints get pigeonholed as irritable bowel syndrome. So you have maybe three or four things in your armamentarium that you do for irritable bowel, and the patient fails these very quickly, and then you kind of feel like you're left with a dissatisfied patient. In addition, diabetics are far more likely to experience GI symptoms compared to your controls. And it's basically every GI organ system that's influenced. So from top to bottom, oropharynx, esophagus, stomach, both small and large intestine, anal rectum, as well as the liver. And I think the liver, you'll come to see in the later slides, is a huge, huge topic of discussion in these patients as sort of a manifestation of their metabolic disorder. And one of the other very interesting things I came across in preparing the slide deck was the cancer concerns in these patients. I think we oftentimes think of diabetes being associated with obesity and some other things. And when these patients turn up with malignancy, you think, well, it makes sense. You know, there are certain malignancies that are associated with diabetes, but actually there are mechanisms going on under the radar that actually work at a cellular level to really create sort of a tumor cocktail environment to be pro-inflammatory and pro-neoplastic in these patients. So starting from the mouth, these patients have about a 30% incidence of oral candidiasis and about a 60% incidence of periodontal disease. They get mucosal ulcerations, which are multifactorial. They end up with dry mouth, and they, like me, end up with dry mouth as well as altered taste sensation, which really affects their quality of life. In addition, these patients will present with their candidiasis with a variety of symptoms, some of which are classic, some of which are not. They'll have the chest pain, they'll have dysphagia and heartburn, they'll have bleeding in some cases, which you'll try to figure out if they have an ulcer or something else, but very oftentimes can be related to the severity of the yeast infection. They have chest pain, dysphagia, and heartburn, which are secondary to the dysmotility, and then obviously reflux. About 63% of these patients will have dysmotility with respect to the esophagus. And there's really no difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetics or between genders. And there's a real strong association with retinopathy. And I think we've become more in tune with this, that if these are a head-to-toe inflammatory destructive process with respect to diabetes. So if you have neuropathy in your feet, chances are you have neuropathy in your abdomen and affecting your GI motility. So both the micro and macro vascular complications of diabetes is going to show up in the GI tract, just sort of guilty by association. Up to 20% prevalence of reflux in the Western world, but then when you talk about your diabetics, the reflux is much more prevalent. Symptoms are as high as 41%, and again, strongly associated with neuropathy. And what's interesting, the patients that are neuropathic have a much higher prevalence of erosive change. And I guess that makes sense because anybody that doesn't have neuropathy is going to feel that erosive change sooner. They're going to present to their doctor or to their pharmacy. They're going to buy medication, try and change their lifestyle. So that's sort of the concern that you have is patients that don't feel it have the worst disease. And those are people that you worry about progressing to strictures and tumors and some of the associated sequelae. With respect to gastroparesis, the way you define this disorder is objectively delayed emptying in the absence of a mechanical obstruction. So these patients present with nausea, vomiting, early satiety, and bloating, as well as upper abdominal pain. The 10-year incidence of symptomatic gastroparesis in the general population is 0.2%. So you can see in type 1 diabetics, they're 5 times more likely to have this, and type 2 diabetics are 5 times more likely. Type 1 diabetics are 25 times more likely to have this disorder. The prevalence of symptomatic gastroparesis, these numbers are a little bit high, I think because they come from early studies that lack some intensive insulin therapy, but still quite compelling. It's 4 times more likely to be in females. And again, you're going to see these patients because women are more common to come into the office with these kind of complaints at a lower threshold than some of the men. The men are going to hopefully try and tough it out, but you do see these patients, obviously, in both of our practices that are coming in. And I think you may associate irritable bowel syndrome with maybe more of a female-type presentation, but again, you really want to be sort of tuned in to these patients that are coming in, both male and female, that these are real issues. With respect to risk factors, elevated hemoglobin A1C is one, as well as a 10-year duration of type 2 diabetes, and the presence of these micro and macro vascular complications. Interestingly, about half of these patients will lose weight, and up to a quarter of patients will gain weight simply because the decreased motility and the decreased absorptive capabilities as things move slowly through the GI system. About a third of patients will have chronic symptoms that will flare from time to time. And about another third of patients will have chronic symptoms that are just continuing to get worse. And they're always worried about what else is going on, what is the doctor missing, what am I missing, what tests do we need to do next. For house staff, one of the things that we've kind of gotten away from is the bedside exam. So when you examine these patients, you're going to hear what's called the succussion splash, which is basically sort of solid food taking a dive into this pool of retained gastric contents. So it's really quite interesting exam finding to demonstrate at the bedside. In terms of affecting the small and large intestine, you're going to have just generalized enteropathy, which is your diabetic enteropathy, autonomic neuropathy. You're going to have small intestine bacterial overgrowth, which has sort of started to become more of a prevalent issue that we discuss nowadays with breath testing and all these talks about fecal transplants and altering the small bowel microbiome. This is an area of huge focus for both medical and pharmaceutical companies in terms of where we go forward with identifying these and treating these disorders. Bile acid-related diarrhea, and I'll talk with you about a couple mechanisms for that. Celiac disease is tightly associated, as well as exocrine pancreatic insufficiency that often flies under the radar with a lot of irritable bowel syndrome type symptoms. The anorectal manifestations, I think a lot of us don't talk to our patients about this, and I think it's because we don't ask, and I think it's because you have to build that doctor-patient relationship where the patient feels comfortable telling you these things. Sort of once you start to peel the onion, and I use that reference because there's a lot of crying involved as well, is that these patients will sort of tell you their life story and tell you how frustrated they are and how upset they are that they just can't leave the house because they're worried about having an accident. They live their lives in constant fear of social situations. And I think that we can service these patients tremendously by at least learning how to ask about these disorders, how to test for them, and then obviously what our treatment modalities are. The hepatic manifestations, which again is becoming a huge issue with our growing population, that's a growing population with obesity. And the three things that we think about is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and then you sort of extend that from just benign fatty infiltration in the liver into something that becomes pro-inflammatory, the so-called NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. And then you think about what's a completely distinct entity that oftentimes gets linked in with fatty liver disease is the manifestation in type 1 diabetics called glycogenic hepatopathy. So you'll see a bright liver on ultrasound in someone with type 1 diabetes, and you sort of brush it off as fatty liver disease. This is actually an inflammation and sort of an installation of glycogen into the liver, which does have its own set of implications. Fascinating enough, we have a lot of oncologic manifestations of diabetes, including pancreatic cancer, which is obviously something we'd like to capture as quickly as possible. Hepatocellular carcinoma, which you worry about the patients with fatty liver that are getting these hepatomas before they even get cirrhotic, so they're not in a surveillance program, and they're just showing up with these 8 or 10 centimeter liver cancers that just blow everybody away because they really had no idea that something like this was going on, and they were in no surveillance program whatsoever. Adenomatous colon polyps obviously are one of those manifestations, as well as colorectal cancer. So now that we've talked about what all these complications are and these associated conditions, let's talk about how these things happen. Sort of, and this is this is sometimes the portion of the lecture I worry about losing people because it kind of gets in the nuts and bolts and the cellular mechanisms. But again, for me, it helps sort of understand why these things happen. If you understand why they happen, I think you become better at treating them. So with respect to the candidiasis issue in these patients, Candida is part of our normal baggage in oral flora, but what happens is that you end up with these high sugar levels, and basically you get increased buccal mucin. So you think of it as a petri dish. Well, suddenly you've deposited all this mucin, and you fed this mucin pool with sugar. So that's a huge petri dish and a pro-growth media for yeast. On top of it, you have decreased salivary lysozyme levels, so whatever yeast is growing, you have less and less of a protective barrier to kill that yeast, and becomes a huge problem for these patients. In addition, if you get reflux up into the mouth or the oral pharynx, you end up getting more inflammation, which then further weakens your protective flora and your cellular barriers. With respect to periodontal disease, you get some compromised neutrophil function as well. As the sugars go up, you get neuropathy and those things. So you get less adherence, less chemotaxis, and less phagocytosis. So again, all these things sort of a perfect storm for complications. With esophageal dysmotility, as Dr. Smith alluded to, a lot of issues are vagal mediated. So this is an autonomic neuropathy, and this affects the myenteric neurons, the interstitial cells of Cajal, which are pacemaker cells of the intestine. You get smooth muscle fiber damage, as well as you get structural remodeling. So you actually get fibrosis of the tissue layers, as well as fibrosis of the musculature. And you know that fibrotic tissue doesn't work well. It doesn't squeeze well, and it doesn't relax well. So that's why these patients have these issues. So if you were to do motility studies on these patients and look at their esophagus, they're going to have a decreased amplitude and a decreased velocity of esophageal contractions. All right, so they're going to basically not be able to clear secretions and food and refluxate out of their esophagus due to their damage. In addition, you have things that are now going retrograde. You have a reduced lower esophageal sphincter pressure, which makes it easier for things to come up. You have an increased number of transient lower esophageal sphincter relaxations, which all of us have these, what are so-called TLESRs. They happen normally throughout the day. Well, diabetics are going to have more of these. So again, more relaxation and decreased sphincter pressure means more stuff's coming up, on top of the fact that these patients get retrograde contractions. All that equates to impaired clearance. In addition, these patients, especially when they get neuropathic, as I mentioned, they're going to get reduced sensitivity, and their severity is going to be inversely proportional to their glycemic control. So how do you find these patients? Sort of how do you tease out which of these patients are going to have problems and which of these patients are the ones that you need to do things? So I think taking a good history exam is important. I think endoscopically evaluating them. And I think pH probe studies are very important with the addition of impedance, which tells you stuff that's coming up. Is it liquid? Is it gas? Or is it mixed? You have the ability to do manometry, looking for contractions, as well as impedance studies. Why do these patients get gastroparesis? Well, they have inflammatory ganglia damage, as well as dropout of the nerve fibers. They have abnormal neurotransmission, as well as they have impaired nitric oxide-related cell activity. So again, these cells are not relaxing. The musculature is not relaxing. So that equals decreased accommodation. You get smooth muscle fibrosis, as well as infiltrates of the immune system into these cells, as well as damage to the pacemaker cells. All that equals decreased contractility. So gastroparesis, when you think about it, it sounds awful, but this is actually the body's way of trying to do something which sounds in theory like a reasonable thing to do, which is basically slowing the release of foodstuffs into the small intestine because the body has detected that the sugar is high. So why does the body need more sugar when the sugar is already high? The trouble with that is that any medication that you try to give by mouth is going to have impaired absorption, and then you also will get hypoglycemia. So these patients' sugars will sort of skyrocket up and skyrocket down. A subset of gastroparesis can be tachygastria, where patients will get rapid gastric emptying, so they will get super high sugar levels, they'll get dumping symptoms as well. In terms of how to diagnose this, gastric emptying studies, so-called gastric scintigraphy, upper endoscopy, sometimes you'll find it incidentally on cross-sectional imaging. There are centers that perform antroduodenal manometry. But one of the things you want to think about is so-called rumination syndrome, where a patient will eat and sort of have this effortless regurgitation of a tremendous amount of stuff into their mouth. And it sounds awful, but they will chew it and re-swallow it. It's sort of like a cow chewing his or her cud. And this is treated completely differently. This is actually something that's treated, you know, with lifestyle changes, so-called diaphragmatic breathing. So you hate to really push a lot of medical treatments on these patients when it's hopefully a behavioral and education-related symptom. With respect to enteropathy, the prevalence of autonomic diarrhea is about 22%, so you always need to exclude a stool infection in these patients. And again, we talked about the neuropathic mechanisms in these patients. Oftentimes, these patients will talk about having tons of diarrhea, but when you talk to them, actually, they have a lot of slow motility. So not all diarrhea is really diarrhea. When you talk to them, they might have days they don't move their bowels for 6 days, and then on the seventh day, they're passing 6 days worth of stool. So that's the day that they worry about. So sometimes you can get just a general x-ray to look for fecal loading in these patients, or you can do a Sitz marker study to see how slow or quickly things move through. And again, talking about disordered fluid transport and electrolyte exchange predisposing them to diarrhea because you get the fibrosis of the tissue layers, making it harder for these nutrients and constituents to diffuse across the intestinal wall. Bacterial overgrowth happens in about 60% of diabetes, and it's secondary to maldigestion or malabsorption because you have an overabundance of bacteria or you have the wrong proportion of bacteria. And we used to diagnose this with jejunal aspirate. Now we have less invasive testing modalities such as breath testing that can be done in an office-based environment. Bile acid-related diarrhea is really actually secondary to a reduced bile salt pool. So what happens is these patients have such a rapid small bowel transit that you get impaired ileal reabsorption. So you start to deplete the overall bile salt pool, and that's why these patients start to get sicker and sicker. In addition, SIBO causes deconjugation of the bile acid, so basically makes it less effective. There are medications that can predispose to enteropathy, including metformin and acarbose. And then sort of this new thing that we're using for a lot of our irritable bowel syndrome patients, the low FODMAPs diet, patients with diabetes oftentimes have a high FODMAPs. FODMAPs are tough to digest sugars that we all get commonly thought of as lactose and fructose, but a lot of other sugar substitutes that when patients take these in, they're very poorly digested. So as they pass through and aren't properly processed, they cause a tremendous amount of bloating, gas, and changes in the stools. Celiac disease is closely associated, so you're diagnosing this either with upper endoscopy and small bowel biopsies in suggestive patients, or the tissue transglutaminase IgA and IgG antibodies, or the anti-endomycial IgA and IgG antibodies. You can check a quantitative IgA level with another IgA-based test, but keep in mind about 7 to 10% of patients are IgA deficient, so that's why I check the IgA and IgG variety so that I'm not asking the patient to go back for a second blood draw. If you have endoscopy or blood work that says, one says you have sprue, the other one doesn't, HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8 testing is sort of the tiebreaker. About 40% of people will have these abnormal alleles, and we know 40% of people don't have celiac, so 40% of people are carriers. The real benefit of this test is actually its high negative predictive value. So you sort of have a patient that's showing up in your office, their sister has celiac or their friend has celiac, and they put themselves on a gluten-free diet, and either they do feel better or don't, and they want to know if they have sprue, or if they've already treated themselves for sprue, doing an endoscopy and doing a blood work is probably going to be normal. So you sort of rely on the genetic test in these patients to say whether you do or don't have it and hope that they have a negative test. You can tell them you may have a gluten sensitivity, but you don't have true sprue. EPI, exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, again, has a lot of these IBS overlap symptoms that I've listed below. Ways to diagnose this can be fecal elastase or fecal fat testing, as well as CT, MRI, or in my case, endoscopic ultrasound is very helpful. A lot of good criteria for that. Talking about the anorectal manifestations, these patients get sphincter dysfunction because of the neuropathy. And as the sugar goes up, so we tell patients with their sugars, with respect to their stomach, sugars over 140 and definitely over 200 is associated with decreased gastric emptying. So the same sort of thing happens with decreased sphincter function when the sugars rise to these levels. Patients can have voluminous loose stool that any one of us would have trouble sort of clenching down and holding, and that's what leads into a lot of these patients' difficulties. And in addition, they have decreased sensation and reduced resting pressure. So not only is this huge flow of stool coming the sphincter's way, the sphincter just doesn't have the ability to sort of hold on to it. Pelvic floor dyssynergia can be diagnosed with anorectal manometry, so-called balloon expulsion test, and defecography. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is sort of the hepatic manifestation of metabolic syndrome of diabetes, hypertension, and hyperlipidemia. This is the most common cause of chronic liver disease in North America, soon to be the most common reason we transplant people, which is pretty amazing. It's about 30% of the U.S. population, but up to 87% of type 2 diabetics. NAFLD is sort of the benign fatty infiltration of the liver, moving on to NASH, which is the infiltration plus the inflammation, and that's up to about 60% of type 2 diabetics. Again, you need to look for confounding factors like do they drink under the radar, do they have steatogenic medications or a hereditary lipid disorder, but the people you really worry about, the people that are now getting HCC, the so-called hepatoma, in the setting of no cirrhosis whatsoever. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And then glycogenic hepatopathy, realizing this is a glycogen, not a fat-related, but a glycogen-related manifestation of type 1 diabetic within the liver. Still very, very inflammatory and very destructive. So why are these patients getting higher risk of tumors? Well, actually, basically, they're getting an elevated level of the epidermal growth factors. So they're getting cell proliferation, they're getting new blood vessels that are forming, and they're getting inhibition of cell death. So if cells can't be shut down, they're overgrowing, and they have a rich blood supply, and then you add IL-6, these pro-inflammatory cytokines to the mix, that's sort of a recipe for disaster with respect to tumors. In addition, they get upregulation of these receptors for these glycation end products. So as hemoglobin A1c, the RBCs get glycated, they attach to these receptors, and that promotes further inflammation as well as tumorigenesis. So really fascinating why this happens, but for me, this was very educational. So this portion of the lecture, too, you're going to hear glycemic control about 1,500 times, but I think that's sort of the underlying theme with a lot of these patients. But again, that's not the whole picture, so I wanted to put that in there for completeness sake, but a lot of the things that we can discuss. Good hydration is important for oropharyngeal manifestations as well as antifungal treatments, both topical and systemic, depending on the comorbidities and the severity of their disease. For periodontal disease, make sure they're getting regular dental cleanings and strict oral hygiene. For esophageal candidiasis, you want to make sure, as Dr. Hoffman nicely said, try and figure out who are the patients that actually need the acid-reducing therapies, getting away at the lowest effective dose for the shortest duration of time, or doing alternative things. And you can still use antifungals if needed. With esophageal dysmotility, acid suppression is helpful, but that's sort of just treating the symptom, doesn't treat the underlying issue. So things like baclofen and erythromycin have been used in some case studies, and in some cases when you have manometrically proven symptoms, then you want to obviously use these medications, knowing that erythromycin does have some tachyphylaxis, so you won't be able to use it long term. You have to use frequent drug holidays. Weight loss, as Dr. Hoffman alluded to in a lot of the treatments, not to go over what he did too much, but a big thing with weight loss is you have to combine exercise with the lifestyle changes. One of the most important things, people are so in tune with grams of fat and total calories, but they really forget about grams of sugar. So I tell my patients, women probably shouldn't have more than about 25 grams of sugar. Men shouldn't have probably about 40 grams of sugar. And they say, well, I eat an Activia yogurt every morning, and I basically have a little bit of flavored creamer in my coffee, but then I don't need any sugar the whole rest of a day. And you say, well, an Activia this big has about 18 grams of sugar, and then that flavored creamer that you use has about another 10 or 12 grams of sugar. So before you've even stepped out of your breakfast, you've had your sugar for the day. So people are sometimes shocked by that, but I think it's an important thing to recognize. In addition, there are going to be the patients that need the acid suppression inhibition, as well as you're going to have those patients that need these prokinetic agents I mentioned. I tell patients 4 to 6 small, snack size, low fat, low carb, low residue meals. So low fiber, low fat, low carb. And I tell patients too that if you're having continued difficulties, sometimes we've learned from our bariatric population, separating out solids from liquids sometimes makes a big difference by about a half hour. In severe cases, sometimes they're on a liquid-based diet. And taking a look at the rest of the medications to make sure they're not on anything else that slows gastric emptying. Sort of the middle three medications, pramlintide, as well as exenatide and liraglutide, those are some of those new GLP-type medications that are injectable. Those have been shown to slow gastric emptying, so it's tough when you're putting a patient on a medication to help their sugars. It might actually be affecting their gastric emptying, so keeping that in mind. THC is a lecture in and of itself, but we know that healthy volunteers that smoke weed, they have decreased gastric emptying, so this sort of adds fuel to the fire in someone that may already have delayed gastric emptying that's now using marijuana. That may be sort of a 1-2 punch for them. Out of all the prokinetic agents that you're well acquainted with, the last one, haloperidol, has been used interestingly in some ER literature in patients to decrease observational unit stage. So I think in the study that was done by them, I think it was nice to see that we're sometimes worried about this drug, but there was not a lot of central side effects with this, and it might become a new drug in our armamentarium. The reason we talk about doing Botox injections is because these patients have a stomach that not only doesn't squeeze and doesn't relax, but also you have pyloric spasm. So basically, you know, whatever motility the stomach can muster, it's pushing against a fixed obstruction. So sort of paralyzing the pylorus, that's what makes sense in these patients, is that whatever sort of force the stomach can generate, if you can decrease the amount of resistance, hopefully you'll improve their quality of life. Gastric pacemakers have sort of made a big resurgence, and I've seen patients do awesome with these. Now, again, these are the patients that they've failed all the lifestyle stuff, they failed all the medications, they really are committed, and you can't tell someone with a hemoglobin A1C of 5.9 or 6 that has neuropathy and has gastroparesis to control their sugar any better. They're already doing what they can. So this has been shown to yield up to an 80% reduction in nausea and vomiting, improve their nutritional status, the metabolic dynamics. You're not getting either delayed gastric emptying causing sugar problems or tachygastria with a whole bunch of food entering the small intestine, escalating their sugar. And overall, their quality of life is better, and they're decreasing their healthcare facilities. They're decreasing their healthcare utilization and using their facilities less. Pyloroplasty has been reported to achieve 83% symptom reduction. Venting G-tubes, I'm not a big fan of because of the mixed results, and you sort of own that opening and that incision once you make it. J-tube has been shown to reduce utilization. And TPN, you always want to think of in the background in these patients with not only severe gastroparesis, but they have a lot of severe small bowel motility issues as well. So you want to switch them from a high FODMAPs to a low FODMAPs, do the sugar restriction that I mentioned. Anything that causes diarrhea, like caffeine or smoking, really try and get out of their lifestyle. You want to make sure you're hydrating them appropriately, replacing any micronutrients, electrolytes, or vitamins. These are some medications listed to help with diarrhea. Again, don't forget, in some cases, very small amounts of codeine might be helpful in these patients. And then the ability to use TPN in patients that are having hypoglycemia episodes secondary to delayed gastric emptying. Exercise is important as well in patients that are constipated. Fiber is helpful, but too much fiber can be a bad thing for these patients. So sometimes you actually need to go the other direction and do the stool softeners. Lubiprostone, which is Amitiza. I tell my patients to take that in the evening because nausea can be a side effect with that. So take it in the evening with a meal in the hopes that the meal sort of offsets some of that nausea as well as they sleep through some of the nausea if it were to happen. Linactylide is Linzess, which has proven to be very helpful with very minimal side effects. And try to avoid purgative laxatives. I guess it depends on the age of the patient, but a young patient that has 60 years ahead of him or her, you don't want them to get laxative dependent. For bacterial overgrowth, rifaximin, xifaxan has been used with tremendous benefit in these patients. Probiotics can be helpful, and I tell my patients, you know, if you have too much bacteria, it sounds counterintuitive, I'm adding more bacteria, but this bacteria I'm adding might outcompete your existing bacteria, decreasing the overall amount, as well as, again, it's not total amount, it's also proportion of bacteria as well. Prokinetics can also be helpful in sort of flushing out the bacteria. And we have patients after colon lavage for colonoscopy presenting with these kind of symptoms. So we know that there's some degree of alteration of the flora with a simple lavage. So sometimes you might be able to use that to your benefit in these patients. If they don't want to take antibiotics or want to try other things, you could do a periodic purge, especially in somebody that has potentially constipation with their bacterial overgrowth. For incontinence, you try and bulk the stool, as well as there are some medications to consider. Pelvic floor dyssynergia, diaphragmatic breathing, as I talked about, can be very helpful with rumination syndrome, where they're having effortless regurgitation. But also diaphragmatic breathing works in a lot of these patients that have a ton of social anxiety with their pelvic floor dysfunction and incontinence, as to help them sort of meditate themselves down to a reasonable level and help with their continence, on top of doing biofeedback, which has been extremely beneficial for these patients when you have a group of people that can educate them properly. Fatty liver, again, a lot of this is redundant, but exercise, glycemic control, sugar reduction, weight reduction, and again, I tell people about a pound a month, you know, set these reasonable goals for yourself, and over a 6 to 12 month period, sometimes these patients have had tremendous improvement in their liver biomarkers, they've had better blood pressure control, better cholesterol control, that metabolic syndrome, all those risk factors decrease. But you're going to sometimes have to rely on medication. So vitamin E for your non-diabetics, and then these other medications that I listed for your type 2 diabetics. Again, keeping in mind your GLP-1 analogs are going to help with your sugar, but also there's gastroparesis concerns. I think there's a huge role for discussion of bariatric surgery in these patients. I'm not against it. I think you just want to make sure that you maximize the lifestyle changes going into it, because those patients, surgery is not the quick fix. They still have to do the lifestyle things along with the surgery. And then you have bariatric endoscopy as a huge growing field in these patients as an alternative. For the glycogenic hepatopathy, again, that's basically just redundant from the type 2 diabetes. For oncologic concerns, pancreatic cancer, we don't start screening people, unfortunately, until someone's had at least 3 first-degree relatives with pancreatic cancer. So there's been studies where metformin has been used, though, in patients with documented pancreatic cancer, and that may extend actually to HCC prevention and colorectal cancer prevention, and metformin has been used in some chemotherapy regimens in patients with pancreatic cancer as well, with good results. I've been adding to my panel of labs for patients that come to see me for fatty liver, an alpha-fetoprotein at least once. I talk to patients about the potential cost up front, but I sort of worry about the patient that has a small hepatoma that I'm just going to focus so much on whether they have some other underlying liver condition besides fatty liver and miss the ability to capture hepatoma when it's early and treatable. So again, if your alpha-fetoprotein comes back elevated, you want to do some sort of contrast examination that's cross-sectional on the liver with CT or MR and make sure they're adhering to standard colon cancer screening guidelines. So in summary, you know, looking back at that pretest, our post-test, we talked about having very, very little at the beginning of the lecture to offer these patients with diabetes suffering from GI complaints. I think we've shown that to be false. I think we have a ton of things to offer these patients, and that pharmacologic treatments as number 2 are not the sole option. I think there's a tremendous amount of lifestyle things that we can do for these patients as well, and they can have coexistent conditions that can worsen symptoms in these patients. So thank you very much.